Welcome to the Sanctuary Podcast, hosted by Angel Deer. In this podcast, we explore the mysteries of spirituality and consciousness. In each episode, we dive deep into the realms of human experiences, our rapidly changing world, and the unseen realms, tapping into the universal wisdom that connects us all. Whether you're a seasoned spiritual seeker, starting to awaken to the possibilities of a more expansive reality, or want support on your journey, this podcast is for you. Join me as we explore topics such as shamanism, spiritual transformation, holistic healing, the medicine path, energy healing, plant medicine, ancient wisdom, and more. Our guests are respected elders and experts in their fields, and we'll learn from their insights and experiences as we journey together on the path of spiritual growth. If you can, please consider supporting this podcast by joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Once again, it is patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Now, let's dive into today's episode.
The reason that I really love working with myth, especially with my clients, is that mythology has this really interesting way of connecting your personal experience, whether you're deep in suffering or, you know, growing a lot or at like a life crossroads or transition, right? And connecting that personal experience, because the myths help us feel and realize and have the perspective to understand that this has all happened before. And I think especially in our world today, you know, which is so kind of isolating and individualized, individualistic, to have that medicine of the collective, right? That like, this is part of a bigger story than just me and my little life.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back on this episode of the Sanctuary Podcast. And I'm really excited to be with Simon today to talk about myth as medicine. So how are you, Simon?
I'm good, Angel. Yeah, slow start to the morning, but that's okay. That's good.
Yes, good to be with you. It's like early spring here, and we have days apparently with some snow and then some sun. It's been interesting weather. So before we dive in into your work and this presence of myth and the mythopoetic in what you do, I would like to ask you about the first time, I guess not when you heard a myth, because maybe fairy tales and myths, we hear them as little boys and we're confronting them, but the first time that somehow something shifted for you, you kind of hooked to it and you felt like, okay, this is medicine and I want to go deeper into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, like you said, I was definitely exposed to myth as a child and studied the Odyssey in high school and kind of, you know, had this more, I would say, like academic or intellectual introduction to mythology as a young person. But things really, I would say, shifted for me sometime in my 20s, when I kind of encountered the work of, let's call them like the mythopoetic elders, so to speak, at least in this country, right? People like Michael Mead, who is lives here in the Pacific Northwest where I live, and people like Joseph Campbell and Robert Bly and Mali Doma Somme, and kind of this whole crew of men and women, you know, Clarissa Pinkola Estes and Marion Woodman being a big part of that as well. And it was really through connecting with those teachers and scholars and writers and thinkers and poets that the world of myth and really mythopoetics, right, which is kind of a more, let's call it, personal study of myth, really, really clicked for me.
Wow. Beautiful. Beautiful. So, you know, I was thinking when I was preparing our interview, how the commonality of people that I and probably we meet in this kind of work is that people are at a certain place in their story and they kind of probably stuck, something is going on, and they are very much under the narrative of the past and the narrative of where they are at, and they have a hard time to imagine, dream, I guess, a different story, a different myth, a different personal story for themselves. So I wanted to ask you about that, and specifically started connecting that to personal transformation, healing work, and how do you see that myth in general can be very useful for people transformation, and how does it work? Why is that so useful for people healing?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think on kind of a foundational level, the reason that I really love working with myth, especially with my clients, you know, and with people, is that mythology has this really interesting way of connecting the personal, your personal experience, whether you're deep in suffering or, you know, growing a lot or at like a life crossroads or transition, right? And connecting that personal experience, that felt emotional journey, to the collective, because the myths help us feel and realize and have the perspective to understand that this has all happened before. You know, this has all kind of been, this path has been trodden by more people than just me. And I think especially in our world today, you know, which is so kind of isolating and individualized, individualistic, to have that medicine of the collective, right? That like, this is part of a bigger story than just me and my little life. Myths can help us get there. Myths can help us do that.
So is that some form of quest of belonging, returning back home? I mean, to a home that maybe we've never met or we've never connected, but that sense that I hear a story or a myth, and I would love for you to give an example, maybe if you have, but I hear something and I feel like, oh yeah, it happened before, or it happened to others, so I am not broken, or I am not separated from the narrative of ancient cultures or that specific story.
Yeah. I mean, even something as sort of mundane as something like depression, right? There are examples or sort of situations in myth that can shed light on that experience, which, you know, when you're in a depression, it's like you're, it feels like you're the only person who's there and the only person who's been there, and you're utterly alone in that experience of depression, right? And myth, I would say, you know, has this medicine of showing you through symbols, right? It's, you know, these stories aren't going to say like, so-and-so got depressed, right? Hercules was depressed one day, right? It's not going to go like that, right? It's going to be more like, so-and-so went down to the underworld and had to sort through, you know, 10,000 grains of wheat to find this one particular type of seed that they had to find in order to kind of make it back to their love so that they could, you know, be reunited with this sense of Eros and aliveness, right? That's Eros and Psyche. That's an ancient story. And Psyche is just going through these trials and these you know, tests to get reunited with Eros, with her love. And we could look at that as like a literal metaphor of like coming into union with another person, or we could look at it also as like a symbol of coming back into love, self-love with yourself, right? What does it take to kind of make it through the dark night of the soul and go through your own personal underworld so that you can kind of be back with your own internal connection to the Eros that lives in you and in everyone, right?
Yeah, this is beautiful. I can feel that. And I guess we all love those tales of the hero, right? That departs, that goes into those scary territories and find the wisdom, find the gem, find the gold, find the precious scroll, and then bring it back to its community, to his community or her community, in order to shift the collective perspective and the collective stories. So, you know, we talk a lot about shamanism in our podcast and in the work we do, where, you know, through the elders that I work with and the tradition of shamanism, there are those different worlds. There is this reality that we are in right now, which is very much driven by the mind or the ego. And then there are the unseen realities, which we access through dream space, for example, when we sleep, which we can access through plant medicine journeys, which we can access through different kind of rituals and ceremonies. And the basic understanding in shamanism is that in order to really understand this world, we need wisdom from the other world. We need to have many, many perspectives in order to understand one thing. And there's also the other layer to that is that, and it's an animistic perspective, is that everything is alive. And so the wisdom is not just within the human kin, but it's also through the plants and the trees, the animals, the rivers, the stars, the land. So there are many wisdom teachers there. So, you know, I often wondered why people love myth so much, because it's often extraordinary territory, meaning out of the ordinary. And nobody is finding it bizarre that Frodo talks to a ring or that he has encounter with mystical beasts. Is it because we have indeed a deep connection with the supernatural, with the invisible, or is it also because, and that's kind of what I've been feeling, that we are craving the mystical, we are craving the non-ordinary in a world that feels very cold and very reduced to one story and one way of seeing things. So it gives us permission in some ways to dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, first of all, I would say that one, I don't think a lot of people are resonant with myth, because I think mythology is sort of, for most people, right, at least in the US, sort of this like old academic tradition, and like maybe someone's heard of Joseph Campbell. But I would say on the grand scheme of things, like most people have, myth does not enter into the popular imagination consciously, right? But that's why we love huge cinematic stories, right? That's why we can't get enough of a story like Dune, for instance, you know, which is like, has so many archetypal threads going on. You know, it's a story, and I would say that on an even deeper level than that, right, the language of the psyche is image. So myths resonate with us on a deep level because they are full of inexplicable symbolic imagery, that some of which is just a complete mystery, and some of which kind of speaks directly to something in our felt experience, in our collective experience as well, and also in our sort of like cultural memory, right? So, I mean, these are how symbols work, right? And then on another level, even deeper than that, I would say what you were speaking to, Angel, of like Western culture kind of made a deal with itself back in what is ironically called the Age of Enlightenment, right? That the only thing that is real is what can be measured, counted, seen, observed, scientifically proven. I think, therefore I am, is the only sort of realm of reality according to sort of modernity, right? And I think all of us now today are sort of sitting with the cost. We're sitting with the bill of that cultural shift. And for many of us, it's no longer working. And we could look at that as like a crisis of mental health, a crisis of addiction, a crisis of meaning, a crisis of belonging and community, right? But I think most people would be pretty hard pressed to say that modernity is still working out well.
Yeah. I mean, maybe not if we watch the news and the main rhetoric, I guess, where it's still, you know, kind of the only narrative available or that should be followed. So in your work, Simon, is that something you see a lot, that this, the cost, I would say, of this narrative and the cost of the disconnection from the storytellers and the myth? You know, every time I go to native communities and people that still live in the ancient ways, the way to teach, the way to heal is a lot through stories, mm-hmm. very ancient stories. And there are tricksters and there are special mythical beings. And there are also stories of the people and what they went through. And it's gifted not with a full roadmap on what you can do with it, but kind of opening your imagination, opening your mind, opening your heart to a different kind of thinking. So when you see the people that you work with, I'm guessing, and the people that come to you for different kind of work, and maybe you want to talk a little bit of how you work with myth, can you see that disconnect between the story that is given to them today through what we call modern culture or Western world vision, and the impact it has on their health, physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual?
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think, you know, the starting place is sort of our collective situation, right? On a cultural level, what are we all working with, right? And I would say any sort of move inwards into the inner world, which is also the mythic world, which is also the shamanic world, is kind of a upstream movement, culturally speaking. So just that, people are going to kind of encounter a lot of resistance, maybe from family or friends, you know, when they kind of start looking inward. Mm-hmm. And I would also say that so much of what I work with and see with people is a crisis of meaning. You know, there is a, you know, you're speaking of indigenous ways and communities and cultures, which, you know, of course have their own struggles, right? Very real struggles. And I think part of the reason that sort of Western white or European culture is so sort of drawn to the indigenous world is because there is some kind of intact thread of meaning there, you know, and that meaning or connection is usually transmitted through stories, you know, through teachings that come in the way of stories, like you're saying, right? So that's kind of half the answer to your question. The other half, I think I heard you kind of asking, like, how do I actually do this work? You know, how does this actually look with people? And, you know, my training is as a psychotherapist, a Jungian psychotherapist. So I work with depth psychology and imagery, right? And whether if that is emerging in someone's dreams or someone's psychedelic experiences, right? Whatever is kind of emerging from the psyche, that is where we start. And if it's some sort of image oriented visual experience, like dreams or psychedelic journeys, or even, you know, I also do IFS or internal family systems therapy, which for me at least is a very visual form of inner work. Those images, those symbols sort of open the door for that process that Jungians call amplification, which is basically connecting that kind of individualized experience or image that is has meaning for that person, right? Mm-hmm. Connecting that to something larger and collective, which kind of shows up in the form of myth. So let's say someone, you know, has a dream about a particular animal. Like, let's say it's a coyote. Well, there's a lot of stories about coyote, you know, and how is coyote showing up in their life, and how might they might need to sort of shift their perspective or sort of turn things over, or sort of where they may be taking themselves too seriously, or what kind of needs to sort of where are they making a mess of things, right, in their life? You know, just something like that can be such a huge doorway into someone's process.
Yeah. And, you know, I appreciate that you also have a background, as I would say, scientific background and training in, you know, modern psychotherapy. And, you know, I wonder, because sometimes many people feel like this kind of work is a little bit out there, working with myths, working with stories, working with archetypes. And feel like, well, this is ancient stories and we're in a modern era. And it feels like we're trying a little bit to either people say, well, you want us to go back to those old ways of being. And it doesn't feel like a moving forward, like bringing, you know, a transformation of this modern era. So I wonder, when we look more at even the collective level, how do you see the importance of myth in order for us to transform and heal from the place we're living in? You know, I'm assuming here that people that are listening are pretty much okay to say, yeah, the world we live in has a lot of pain, a lot of struggles, and is not very healthy for most people. And at least as communities, it doesn't really work that well.
Yeah, what I would say, you're asking like, why are these stories relevant?
Yeah, most people would say, well, we just need more science, right? We are going to have AI that is going to solve all our problems. We just need to invent the next pill in order to, you know, change that. We need to somehow green the whole earth and, you know, use solar panels and green energy transitions, and we're going to be fine, right? So there's always a kind of a more technical, mind-centric visions of how we transform, right, that is not always or ever rooted in ancient stories and ancient wisdom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Think about this for a moment. All of the problems and crises in our world, climate change, geopolitical issues, resource scarcity, right? Humanity has all of the information it needs to solve the problems, right? And yet they continue. So it's not a lack or need for more information that is going to I would say, help us out of this collective predicament that we're in, because we already have all of the information. We know how to solve climate change. And yet, for whatever reason, right, things are unable to shift in that direction. So I would say that, you know, science is really great at what it's good at, and bad at what it's not good at. And where science kind of I would say, loses some of its potency is in these kind of inexplicable, irrational, confusing, mysterious realms of the human experience and human culture, right? And kind of taking that a level deeper, right? Like, we can't locate depression in the brain. Depression as a chemical imbalance, which was sort of the kind of dominating narrative about what depression is for decades, was just thoroughly debunked in the last couple of years, right? So depression can't be located in the brain. It's not a chemical imbalance. And we're no closer to understanding a phenomenon like schizophrenia than we were 100 years ago. We have theories, right? Maybe it's dopamine, maybe it's serotonin, maybe it's kind of all these sort of mechanistic theories, right? And some of them, you know, can hold water a little bit, but they don't explain the experience or the phenomena of something like schizophrenia, just like they don't explain the experience or phenomena of depression, right? I mean, so often, you know, especially in my psychedelic therapy work, right? I've had so many folks come to me or come on a retreat that I was leading and say, like, you know, oh, I'm just here to reset my default mode network. I just want to take psilocybin because I heard that, you know, my default mode network is needing some reset, and I'm here for that reset of my brain. And it's kind of always a process of like, uh-huh, okay, well, we can do that. And tell me about your life. Tell me about where you find meaning. Tell me about your friendships. Tell me about your relationship. Tell me about your relationship with your family. Tell me about, you know, where you derive a sense of meaning and purpose. Mm-hmm. And usually things kind of start to unfold that go far beyond the realm of pharmacology, of neuroscience, of psychiatry. And even, I mean, we would joke at the retreat center that I worked at down in Jamaica that we were an atheist rehabilitation clinic because, you know, after three very strong doses of psilocybin, even the most devout atheists come away kind of questioning if everything is, after all, kind of just a meaningless conglomeration of molecules.
Mm. I really love that because I think that's what really missing personally is that this deep sense of meaning for most people's life beyond a very materialistic meaning that has been kind of learn, right? Okay, I need to get this job and, you know, buy this car and get a family. And once I have all this, I'm going to feel better. And I'm always interested when I get clients coming that have all that and that are in a massive crisis of meaning in their life, purpose in their life. So what you're telling me basically would not work to just put serotonin in the drinking water of the general population for depression to disappear, right? That we need something
else. I'm pretty sure Aldous Huxley wrote a book about that, and it's called The Island, right?
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I want to kind of bring the work of the mytho poets, or the mythopoetic work, because I love Michael Mead, and there are many others out there that I really resonate with. And first, can you define what are mythopoetics, and also how do you see that as something that is really key in the work we are doing in the world that we are in today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mythopoetics, the simplest way to define mythopoetics is I would say kind of crafting meaning out of story. or, you know, poesis means to kind of create something, right? And mythos is story. So there's this sort of interplay between meaning, creation, and story. And what that looks like, you know, often is you hear a story, you hear a myth, you sit with it, you notice kind of the imagery in the story unfolding, and maybe you find later that day, maybe you find the next day, maybe it's a week later, something in that story, some little image or moment or juncture, right? Something that the character did or something someone said is kind of still lingering there with you. And that's the doorway into a deeper relationship and process with that story. So that's, I would say, kind of, I would almost call it like the traditional way, right? Like that's how Michael Mead and others work, is kind of asking that very simple question, where are you in this story? And that becomes kind of the entry point for deeper work. There's, I would say, even more we can do to work in a mythopoetic lens that is kind of the other way. It's sort of like almost like the back door, which is more traditional in psychoanalysis and Jungian work, which is to kind of work with the raw imagery emerging from someone's unconscious through dreams, through psychedelic integration, right? Through kind of deep forms of therapy. The psyche will speak for itself. And then it's a matter of, like I said, figuring out how that personal experience is connected and linked by this sort of thread to something collective and mythic, right? There's always kind of mythic and archetypal themes that emerge with someone every time I do dream work or psychedelic integration support or IFS sessions. There's always something in that person's unique unconscious experience that is linked to something archetypal, collective, mythological.
Yeah, that was going to be what I wanted to ask you, is that the fact that when we connect to the story, it resonates with some kind of old part of the self, an archetype, something that happens to us in childhood that maybe we are forgotten about. And that feeling of belonging with the story, of connection with the story, relation to the story, is because there's a part of us that is finally feeling that it is seen, that it can be, you know, integrated back. As it is integrated in the myth, it can be integrated back into our own myth, into our own story, our own bodies and mind.
Yeah, and I would say that is where the meaning part comes in. Mm-hmm. In that integration is where we craft that meaning for ourselves. Because if that kind of full circle completion isn't made in this work, right, it can be a really easy way to bypass what's actually going on, or kind of just like drift off into archetypal fantasy world and kind of like stay in this sort of mythological fantasy. If we don't make that full circle completion back into really integrating it into like, well, what does this actually mean in my life? You know, what do I need to change?
Yeah. So how does the imagination, what's the part here for imagination, right? For this part of us, like the fantasy of the self, I call it sometimes, right? It's the thing, but sometimes it's very relevant because we get new ideas and new direction in our life. So how does that connect, and how do we really understand imagination from your perspective? What do you think it is? I mean, I have some ideas, but where does that come from, that visualization, that completely new narrative that sometimes is so far from anything we've ever seen or read or believed.
Yeah. I love this question. And I would say that it's all imagination. And Hillman said soul is imagination. And I mean, one way I think we could define depression, right, is a collapse of imagination. And anxiety is sort of like a, you know, runaway train of imagination. And PTSD, trauma, right, is sort of imagination turned into a monster that then is expressed through the body, right? So it is all about imagination. And I think this is like such an interesting, you know, I think about like imagination kind of has this like association with children, right? And childhood. And rightfully so, because children are like the most imaginative beings, right? They show us like what it's like to live fully in the imagination, right? And, you know, it's almost kind of like the, as adults, we get calcified in our unimaginative ego. And that's where this sort of dimming down of the world occurs. You know, that's when the cubicle worker is just ground down into a, you know, depressed blob of nothing, because there's no kind of room for the imagination to flow. I mean, imagination can save someone's life, you know, and I know for many people it has, for sure.
You know, it reminds me what an elder told me recently, a few months ago. He said, we're in a crisis of dreaming, a crisis of imagination, a crisis of story. That's really the problem. It's not really the crisis we are seeing. It's our incapacity to imagine something different. And I really feel that, you know, in the world. I love how you describe depression and anxiety and the connection to imagination. There's something quite terrible I feel we've done to ourselves. Is like we are nurturing children's imagination. We read them beautiful myth and stories and fairy tale. We encourage them, at least I believe most parents, you know, when we're a young age, to talk to the trees and the fairies and pick up a rock and, you know, see something different or look at a cloud and they see animals. And we really encourage that sense, that skill, which is, I think, really important. Obviously, that what keeps children open to life and curious and engaged. And then somehow we go through that rite of passage, modern one, of adolescence, where now we have to be very serious. And our imagination is just stories. It's not real. It's not true. It has no relevance because it's not real. And so we kind of starve ourselves from something we've developed for so many years. And is it that the myth today, mythology, mythopoetics, they are basically spoon feeding honey to that little child inside of us. And that's what makes us feel so alive. At least that's how I feel when I listen to Michael Mead, when I listen to, you know, a lot of those mythopoetic people out there. Is it my inner child that is being really fed something really delicious?
Yeah. And I think some of us need more than just a spoonful. I think some of us need a fire hose,
a bath,
and a bath. Yeah, a constant supply. And I think honestly, that's why psychedelics are kind of coming in so strong to our culture, because, you know, these medicines kind of undeniably open up that imaginal quality. And sure, it's maybe not pure imagination, right? It's not endogenous, right? It's not just something we kind of can do in our minds. But I would say, I think that's kind of where we're at as a people, right? Is like, we've forgotten how to dream, like your elder said, you know? And I think that is why, one of the reasons why psychedelic medicines are kind of having such a moment right now, because these medicines, part of what they do is help us remember how to dream, help us remember that life is magical, help us remember that the trees are alive and the stones have something to say, you know, and I think that's kind of the deepest medicine of some of these plants and substances, right? It's not just, you know, I say in one of the very first pages of my book, right? Psychedelics are not about improving mental health. They're about increasing this imaginative potential and way of relating with the living world.
And, you know, you live in a state or in a place where, you know, doing this work as a psychotherapist and with psychedelic is legal. But in most of the country, at least where I live in New York State and many other places, you know, psychedelic have been criminalized and, you know, this work is not possible. So people have to travel to access that. But I'm wondering if you ever thought or wondered why the criminalization is there. And is this, you know, without going into conspiracy theories or, you know, dark evil governments, but more for, I would say, a more subconscious aspect of society, a desire to control a certain narrative. Because if you reduce imagination from people, if you don't give other options, then you have no options than to follow one narrative. And do you feel that's maybe literally, probably completely subconsciously, what the system is in place have done in order to kind of cater to a certain narrative of us being in this world?
You're asking why are psychedelics illegal?
No, there are many reasons they are, right? But more about, is there a subconscious part of the self, the parts that is in the collective myth that we are living in, does not allow imagination, does not allow alternative stories or even alternative behaviors, where we could talk a lot about part of the mental health crisis and how those people would be treated if they were in a native community compared to how they are treated, you know, in our world today. Is that a way to say, no, this is not allowed. You cannot dream. You cannot, you know, bring forth a different stories. And I'm not just talking about the self, but the collective also.
Yeah. Yeah. I think where my mind goes to is this thing that we are all living in and under, which is called empire. And I don't think, I think it is against the best interest of this sort of being called an empire, right, to have alternative narratives and stories. And, you know, it tracks very much with the history of colonization of North and South America, right? It tracks that the church and the kind of European powers, you know, forbid the native people of these lands from practicing their traditions, right? Because it was a source of power and imagination and meaning that was not beholden to the empire that wants to control this place, right? And we can go further back, right, in history to, you know, the European spread of Christianity, and it's the same thing, you know.
Yes.
So it's really, I would say this idea of kind of empire, control, colonization, and what it means to kind of have, let's call it an indigenous soul, right? Or a soul that is alive and connected to the earth.
Yeah, that's a good transition for something I want to ask you about and transition into, you know, because we've been in that such materialistic place. And to be honest, I find it quite metallic I mean, it's like a cold metal that doesn't have much soul, that doesn't have the heart, that doesn't have the feelings. We have also seen the land the same way. We have disconnected from the land, and the land is just has become a resources. It's just the place where we get what we need. And there is not that connection back to land really as a living being, as something that is entitled to rights. And that needs to be cared for, not just for us, but for our children and grandchildren. So in Native stories and in myth, there are a deep connection to land. But can you talk a little bit about why that myth and those stories can help us reconnect back to land and heal the lands that is in dire need of healing?
Yeah, I've heard it said from many different mythologists. You know, there was a famous Greek mythologist that was a colleague of Carl Jung's named Karl Kerenyi. He's a Hungarian mythologist, and he wrote, mythology is the world telling itself its story. And, you know, I've heard from more contemporary teachers, like Martin Shaw, I believe, has said, the earth thinks through myth. And it kind of, it's going, you know, if we're going to take that seriously, it's an interesting, humans play kind of an interesting role in that, right? Because if the earth thinks in myth, or myths are the world telling itself its own story, then, you know, we as human beings play this really interesting, pivotal role in sort of telling the earth its story back to itself through us, which is sort of this like weaving of belonging, you know, through the very act of telling the story. It reminds me of when I was 20, I went to Australia and got some money from my university to go live in an Aboriginal Australian community in the Northern Territory. And, you know, in Aboriginal Australian culture, there's this idea of the dream time and the dreaming, and everyone has their own dreaming. And dreaming is sort of a interesting sort of kind of problematic word that kind of was given to label Aboriginal spiritual identity and creation mythologies, but they ran with it, right? So they go with it. But the dreaming and someone's personal dreaming is this really beautiful, profound link in a chain. It's like their personal story connected to this larger story of this dreaming ancestor that walked all over the land and did all these different things all over the land. And so one person's dreaming might be one little link in that chain and a specific part of the land that they're the caretakers to. And every time they recite and sing their dreaming, they're connecting their personal spiritual identity to this larger dreaming ancestor that is interwoven in these song lines all over the land, right? So it's this beautiful kind of like wheels within wheels of spiritual belonging and identity that has the land as the basis of it all.
That is so beautiful. I can deeply feel it. You know, Simon, it reminds me years ago, I think almost 10 years ago, I was looking for a Lenape elder. So we're on Lenape territory here at the sanctuary. And a lot of Lenape people have moved out. Many were exterminated, or they just move on Five Nation Reservation in Canada or down south in PA. And finally, you know, I got to meet a grandmother Lenape, and we started building a relationship since then. And I invited her to come to the land here one day to spend an afternoon, to do a ceremony, to do some blessing on the land. It was really special to have her around and just the ceremonies and have her. And the land didn't have any Lenape ceremony, this specific land, for, you know, a few hundred years now. And at some point in the afternoon, she started to sing Elena Pesson that she knew from her grandmother. And she sang that song with her rattle or a drum, I can't remember now. And where there was like 10 of us there, we all started getting very grieving and tearing up and having those tears in our eyes. We were somehow very moved. She shared many other things, but that song somehow really made us very emotional. And when she finished the songs, hundreds of different birds of different species came into the trees around us, perched on all the trees and started singing. And other animals and deers were walking by. And it's like the whole forest reacted, the land reacted to that old language that the land hadn't heard in centuries. And, you know, we've done singing on the land. We've done offering to the land. But this was probably one of the most profound response of the land saying, oh, I'm so happy to hear that song back again. Right. So it's a little bit what you were sharing. There was something that I can hardly put into words, but that everybody who was there experienced. The land remembered the songs, remembered the stories, and was really happy to hear it back again. So you really remember what you just shared.
Mm. Yeah. And there's something in there too about language, right? Mm. Like the land probably remembers the language too.
Mm.
And that Lenape language is uniquely suited, uniquely emergent from where you are in New York, what is now called New York, right?
Yes, and yeah, the Catskills.
Yeah. And, you know, I work with a Navajo or Diné elder here in the Pacific Northwest. He lives up here, but he prays in his Navajo language. You know, he prays in Diné. And, you know, when I hear him speak that, it's like listening to the desert winds move across the sand and like listening to, you know, that landscape. It's encoded into the language. And that's a profound thing, you know, and the language here in the Pacific Northwest is totally different and, you know, is a bizarre creature, full of strange sounds. And, you know, it's very, very unique, right? But, and then here we are conversing in English, which is this like mishmash of Germanic and Romantic languages and sort of now, you know, Google is a word in the dictionary. And like, so like, what is this language that we're speaking in, you know? Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think that's like a deeper layer of this whole thing. That is like a deeper layer of this sense of identity and belonging and meaning, right? It's like we're conversing in this strange sort of trade language, you know. But does it grow corn? Does it work for us, right? Does it make the birds sing in the trees? I don't know. I think we're kind of figuring that out.
Mm. Yeah, I love that. Yeah, I mean, we could have spoken French without the Louisiana Purchase, probably, in this country.
That's right. That would be a much prettier language, wouldn't it?
But I hear you that there is this special connection, right, between the songs. And very often, you know, when Native community are colonized, one of the things that is not allowed is their language. And to spoke their language, you know, I'm mm-hmm. working with a Lakota grandmother that is based in South Dakota. And she remember boarding school where every time she would speak by mistake, and she was, you know, very little, 5 or 6 years old, a Lakota word, they would put soap in her mouth and she had to eat the soap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she was beaten too. But it was not about her learning English. It was about them not remembering their stories, because their stories, many of them, cannot be really properly translated, and they lose their power once you use English words. In fact, just for the word rains, there are like 20 different ones, and we only have rain, right? So it's very hard to translate very often the meaning of those myths and stories once we extract them from their culture.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So do you see that as a problematic sometimes for certain myth or things we are using? And obviously we have to go with it because we don't speak those old languages and we don't speak Greek for certain, you know, those myth. But I know that even the translation from Greek to English lose power. We lose potency in some degree,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's the best we have, right? Mm. And there is, of course, a certain level, a massive level of grief with that. And, you know, I think humans are miraculous creatures. We're kind of evolutionarily unprecedented on this planet, right? So I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, we can still make it work out despite all this loss, you know. But what I would say also is, like, yes, there are certain layers of meaning and spiritual relevance and teachings that is encoded into language, that is represented in story, right, that you cannot get if you don't know that language, for sure, whether if it's Lakota or Greek or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And at least this is my experience, with enough kind of diligence and devotion, there can be little threads of those deeper meanings that can kind of reveal themselves through deep work with story, whether if it is kind of, yeah, I mean, like, I worked with a couple different Greek myths in my book, The Myth of Medusa and The Birth of Hermes. And both of those stories, right, are not in their original language, right? I don't speak Greek. And yet through kind of research and time and kind of intuition and both academic research and kind of that personal mythopoetic intuition, right? The stories start to reveal themselves and they open up, you know, and information kind of flows from them. And so let's say there's like a native story that, you know, you hear from your Lakota teacher, right? Like, I guarantee you with time, you know, and I'm sure you're doing this, but right, it's like, I guarantee you with time, with that culture, with that person, those threads of meaning will reveal themselves, you know, through relationship.
Mm. Yeah, it's the key here, relationship, right? With the self, with the story, with the land. So I like that you bring your book. I want to ask you about your favorite character in myth, or your favorite, what do you have a favorite story or archetypes? And also if you can connect that to kind of where I want to get here at the end of this talk together, talking about, okay, for the time we're in, what is the story that we need here? What is the best myth that we could read? Or is it one of your favorite one, or is it a completely different one? Are we writing a new mythology right now? So I would like, you know, there are many questions here, but let's start about your favorite characters or archetypes that maybe, and why are they your favorite?
Well, I don't want to name a favorite and then sort of, you know, exclude
you
the
other
one
that are behind and like, no.
Yeah. And then pay the retribution of excluding the others. So I'm sensitive to that, but
so
I don't know.
We're sitting in a circle around you. What are those characters? Or what other ones you want to mention?
Who's sitting in the circle? Mm-hmm. I mean, I have a raven feather right here behind me. And Raven is kind of the trickster character here in the Pacific Northwest. And I love trickster stories. I think the character of the trickster, the archetype of the trickster, is such profound medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think increasingly so in our kind of strange hyper-digital age, because the trickster is also the sort of messenger, right? Think about how many messages we send in just one day. How many text messages, emails, whatever, phone calls. We are in an age of hyper-connectivity, right? And because of that, one could say from a sort of mythopoetic lens, right, that trickster is amplified because there's so much communication, which means there's so much more opportunities for miscommunication, which means there's so many more sort of different narratives and stories going on, which means that there's more kind of edges and boundaries between ideologies, between people, between, belief systems, right, that are kind of all butting up against each other, right? There's so many kind of cracks, I would say, within and between people these days. And the cracks are where trickster lives, you know? There's a lot of stories of like trick, especially there's this one story from the Yoruba people in Nigeria of Eshu, who's their trickster god. And I think about kind of all of the, here's the story. There's this peaceful village, and everything's fine. They're prosperous. And one day the god Eshu decides to come down and kind of test them, basically. So he rides his horse between two fields that are kind of cultivated by two old dear friends. And on half of his body, he paints himself white, and on half of his body, he's black. And he rides down the middle of the field, right? Again, here's this image of like two kind of boundaries coming together. Eshu rides down the road between the two fields. The two farmers at the end of the day are like, hey, did you see that white man on the horse walk between our fields? And the other's like, yeah, but he was definitely black. And then the other's like, no, he was white. And then they go back and forth and they're arguing about whether the man was wearing a white hat or a black hat, right? Basically. And, you know, fighting ensues, and the village sort of has this whole kind of, animosity, and there's this like disagreement. And Eshu comes back and is like, hey, you didn't ask, you didn't sort of counter, you didn't take Eshu into account when you thought about this. You didn't make space for me in your thinking. Mm-hmm. And he kind of wags his finger at them. And, you know, it's a teaching story, right? And I think it's kind of the perfect story, especially for our kind of digital age of increasingly kind of polarized ways of communicating and being, especially online, right? Every time there's like online nonsense going on, I think of that story and Eshu kind of riding down between the two fields and is like wagging his fingers like, oh, you silly humans.
You must think about it a lot, right?
Yeah, I think about it a lot. Yeah. And it helps me from engaging in this most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I, you know, the rare occasions where I sort of fail, I always feel Eshu kind of wagging his finger. It's like, you mm-hmm. asked for it, man.
Thank you for sharing that. It's beautiful. So I want to finish here with, you know, talk a little bit about your book, and also how would you recommend people to, you know, if they really felt something deep here, which I felt, and that there's a lot there for us in the myth, how do we incorporate this into our modern lives, right? Do we just read myth once a week? Do we study a story? Do we do group lectures with each other and confront our ideas? Kind of the practicality of bringing that into our lives for healing, for our transformation, for collective wisdom too. So what would be your recommendation for people that are interested? Say, you know what? I think I should do more of that, whatever that is.
Whatever that is. Yeah, I don't know what that is.
Mm.
I don't know what that is that we're that people should do more of. Like I said, the psyche will speak for itself. And I think any form of real inner work can be mythopoetic work, right? Any form of sort of sincere inner exploration can connect to this kind of larger mythopoetic lens of perception, because that's really what it is. It's a way of perceiving the world. And, you and I have been fortunate enough to have had contact with indigenous teachers and elders, right? Who I would say also work in a mythopoetic way, right? Mm-hmm. That teaching through story is mythopoetics, plain and simple, you know? I think it's also part of the reason why, you know, indigenous people and knowledge is so necessary and precious, you know, and needs to be preserved and has so much to offer the world, right? And why these communities deserve our respect and protection. Hmm. So that's one thing I'll say. And, you know, doing your own work. I imagine a lot of people listening are working with, you know, perhaps psychedelics and plant medicine in some way, or maybe they have more of a sort of imaginal practice of dream work, or maybe people do breath work, or maybe people are, you know, poets and writers and musicians. All of that is an entry point. All of that is imaginal mythopoetic work. And so, you know, I always like to say that it's like, it's not taking psychedelics isn't the work, right? It's what you do with that kind of imaginal expansion and how you complete that circle and bring it into your life, you know? So that's what I'll say about that. Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you, Simon. Such a pleasure having this conversation with you. And for people listening on the podcast, you know, you can find all the details about Simon and his work and his book. I really recommend to read it and to explore that. And if you're here on YouTube, you know, you'll find it right below the video here. So thank you so much, Simon, for the
thank you,
time today. Really appreciated this talk, and yeah, I wish you a beautiful spring season, and yeah, I'll be on the lookout for the Trickster. I think we're in an election year, so I think that might be a little bit of
Trickster
that.
Will be around. Yeah,
it will be around.
You might even elect a Trickster. Who knows?
Right, that's what I heard. Maybe, yeah, we'll see.
Yeah,
thank you so much, Simon. Much blessing to you and for everyone listening. Thank you so much for supporting and for listening today, and wishing you all a great rest of the day. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the Sanctuary Podcast. We deeply value your support. Please consider sharing this podcast with others and joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. Once again, it is patreon.com/thesanctuaryny. At The Sanctuary, we believe that spirituality is a personal journey that takes many forms, and we honor and respect all paths to awakening and the rise of consciousness. Our mission is to provide a platform for open and honest conversations about spirituality and to inspire and empower our listeners to live their most authentic lives in good relation to each other's, the living, and invisible worlds. I look forward to connecting with you again here, or at our events, retreats, and online gatherings. You can find all our offerings at thesanctuaryheal.com. Once again, it is thesanctuaryheal.com.